Guadalajara, Mexico, May 28, 2004. Thousands of protesters gathered on the streets in a mobilization from throughout Mexico, Latin America, and the world to oppose the third summit of the ALCUE, which gathered representatives and presidents from 25 European countries, joined by 33 of their Latin American and Caribbean counterparts, for closed-door negotiation sessions regarding economic and political policies affecting more than 1 billion of the world's people. In response to the demonstrations in Guadalajara, the Mexican state orchestrated a police forces operation where many demonstrators were rounded up, severely beaten, and in many cases tortured during their subsequent detention. Human rights organizations from throughout the world, such as Amnesty International, have condemned the Mexican state's treatment of the Guadalajara demonstrators. The Battle of Guadalajara continues. More than 4 months later, upwards of 15 activists are still imprisoned, 12 are ineligible for bail, and 43 more face grave charges of riot, assault on police officers, destruction of property, and carrying arms. During the past months, people from throughout the world, from Europe to the South Pacific, have demonstrated at Mexican consulates in support of those arrested at Guadalajara and to demand that those being currently detained are released. Over the next hour, you will hear a series of interviews and presentations concerning the May 2004 Guadalajara mobilization, the repression at the hands of the Mexican state suffered by demonstrators, while also interviews providing context and insight into the concrete effects of neoliberal economic policies on the people, economy, culture, and environment of Mexico. We will first hear an interview with a social justice organizer and anarchist based in Mexico City, who is involved with the mobilization against the Guadalajara Economic Summit.
My name is Irina Arellano, and I belong to the Caravana Libertaria Carlo Giuliani in Mexico City. I'm basically... The summit that happened in Guadalajara was ALCUE, which is a summit with the Latin American and European Union presidents. They were going to discuss free trade policies. And, well, since the very first day we got in Guadalajara, we were harassed constantly. The cops were following us, like, everywhere we go. They were asking all these questions. They even tried to arrest some people, like, in the very first day because they were just hanging out in a park, and they said it was illegal to be in the park. So the whole atmosphere around Guadalajara was, like, very hostile since the very first day. So the second day and the night before, well, everyone was, like, really tired, and everyone was, like, kind of scared of what was going to happen. So that was, like, the legal march, the one in the 28th. Where most unions and other organizations were going to demonstrate as well. So it was going to be the biggest march, the biggest event. And, of course, that was the last day of the summit. Basically what happened, we left from one of the main monuments in Guadalajara, which is a fountain. And so we were there, like, pretty much all the organizations, even political parties were there demonstrating. The march was actually very long, from that monument to downtown of the city. It was, like, really close to the area where the summit was taking place. So we were, like, marching. A lot of people was, like, handing out flyers. Some people were doing political graffiti. But that was pretty much it. Like, nothing else happened. Like, no destruction, no nothing. It was just like that. And then when we were getting closer to the downtown area, it was really weird because all the way from the monument to downtown, we had, like, very few cops around, pretty much in bike or walking, but we were expecting, like, a lot more. because the whole downtown area was like surrounded like with a lot of police. And when we were downtown, we realized it was like a huge barricade with cops and other things. So we were there, people were like chanting, and we had some band playing drums, and suddenly like a group of people started running like in the front of the demonstration, and they had like sticks and other things, and they were like shaking the fence. So they were in the front lines, and then most people said, well, so what are we going to do now? So we all decided that we were going to resist. And then the police started throwing gas at us. It was like tear gas in the beginning. And then it was this really weird kind of gas that I've never seen before. First it was like green and then turned yellow. And that was like really, really bad. Like everyone's face itched really, really bad. Like some people got it in their face or arms and they were like super red. And well, so then we realized that, well, we are going to get arrested if we are still here. So we were trying to leave in an organized way so people don't panic and start running and then the cops go and try to chase us. So we were, like, organizing again, and some people who were, like, resisting and waiting for the people who were in the front lines, they started to get, like, injured really, really bad because the cops were, like, approaching. And, well, the cops were beating up everyone. Like, no matter if they were just, like, standing there, they even were beating up pedestrians who were, like, around that area. So after that was, like, all the panic. Like, a lot of people started running. And, well, some people made it, some people don't. And after that, they were just arresting people randomly in the street based on the way they look, or if they looked young, or if they were wearing black clothes or their hair, or if they had, like, any piercings, stuff like that. They even arrested people who had no idea what was going on in 2 or 3 miles away from the demonstration. And they were doing that till 1 a.m. They keep, like, arresting more people. So at the end, they ended up arresting, like, 150 people. And we didn't know what was going on, like, if we were looking for the people and we were giving their names and they would say they have no idea where they were because they said, like, a lot of different cops from different districts participated in the arrest. So they were saying that most people were, like, in different places. So they didn't have, like, a record of names or nothing about the detainees. And they had the detainees incommunicated for 48 hours or maybe more. And, well, it was a very stressful situation. Like, a lot of people disappeared. We didn't know where they were. The police wouldn't give us any information. They even were denying our lawyers access to the information. Nothing. It was a very stressful situation.
Human Rights Watch, based in New York City, stated in a recent report concerning Guadalajara that they have, quote, received credible accounts from former detainees of police brutality, including physical abuse aimed at forcing false confessions to crimes that they say they did not commit. In this light, human rights organizations, including Amnesty International, and social justice activists throughout the world continue to demand the release of those currently imprisoned in Guadalajara. Among the wide range of Mexican society which mobilized for the demonstrations in Guadalajara was the large umbrella organization, the Mexican Network of Action Against Free Trade, or REMALC. You will now hear a segment from an interview with Hector de la Cueva of REMALC concerning the Guadalajara summit.
Bueno, en Guadalajara se realizó, tenía lugar una cumbre oficial, una cumbre de gobiernos, América Latina, Unión Europea, y ahí se dieron cita a diversas organizaciones sociales y movimientos.
Well, in Guadalajara, there was an official summit meeting between Latin America and the European Union, and in this place, several social movements converged with the purpose of proposing an alternative vision to what the governments were discussing in this meeting. And of course, these alternative proposals culminated in a large-scale manifestation. Because in the end, the vision that social Europe is better than treaties signed with the United States is a myth. In fact, treaties with the European Union correspond also to the interests of the multinationals. So there was a protest, a mobilization. It arrived to downtown Guadalajara, although it was a very organized and coordinated protest. In one way or the other, confrontation starts with the police, the manifestation ends, and some groups take off, some others stay. And in a certain moment, the police decides to launch tear gas. After that, they take up the manifestation, dispersing and repressing the protesters. That wasn't the worst of all, because the government can argue that it was reacting to the attacks from which he was the victim, imposing order, etc. The worst thing is what happened after, because the majority of the more than 100 persons detained were arrested after the manifestation took place. Several were arrested hours after the protests ended in places far from where the protests occurred. What happened is that the police spread a net all over the city and arrested overall young people because of the way they looked, without even considering if they had been part of the protest. There was a big number of arbitrary detentions, and this is still not the worst thing. The people that were arrested and taken to the basements of the public ministries were submitted to torture in a scale that a long time was not seen in this country.
Ni siquiera participaron en la manifestación. Entonces hubo una cantidad de detenciones arbitrarias muy grandes, y todavía esto no fue lo peor, sino que a los detenidos que se llevó a los separos de la policía, a los sótanos, se le sometió una tortura que hace mucho que no se veía en México, por lo menos en esa escala. Por eso decimos que hay un retroceso histórico con esto que pasó en Guadalajara, porque nos trae a otros tiempos que supuestamente estaban superados, nos regresa a los años 70 a la represión de las manifestaciones estudiantiles. Y los 60's.
That is why we say that there was a historical relapse with what happened in Guadalajara, because it's like going back to other times that supposedly were surpassed, like the late 60s and 70s, that takes us to the repression of student manifestations. So the young people that were detained and that remain in jail were brutally tortured. They put plastic bags in their heads to asphyxiate them. They were beaten up. They gave them electrical shocks. Women were forced to take off their clothes and to do sit-ups in front of the police. They tried to rape them. There was one guy that broke a finger because he didn't sign a false declaration. There was a boy who recently had a throat operation. He couldn't talk, and they forced him to talk, etc. So the police of Guadalajara conceded that in their jails happened the same things that happened in the jails of Iraq. It was a real brutality what occurred there, to the point that all the instances of human rights organizations from all over the world have pronounced condemning that brutality and torture. So we are living a clear violation of human rights and of international norms. And up to today, there are still more than 10 persons incarcerated by absurd charges, and more than 40 continue to be in legal process, although they are free. So this is a very serious event that happened in Mexico during this occasion in Guadalajara.
Pero que a los cuales se les niega la libertad, y más de 40 que siguen procesados, aunque estén en libertad. Entonces esto es un acontecimiento muy grave que ocurrió en México durante esa ocasión en Guadalajara.
Y people from throughout the world attended the demonstrations in Guadalajara and experienced the police brutality and state repression. Montreal activist Lalu Desperé Roux was arrested, incarcerated, and beaten in the jails of Guadalajara, eventually deported from Mexico to Canada.
I got beaten up first. I didn't get arrested first. I got beaten up, and then I went to the hospital, and then I passed a few hours there. And when I went off of the hospital, they arrested me because they got the order to, like, arrest everybody who was going out of the hospital. And they start searching all around the city. They took person out of the taxis. They took person out of bars. All the young person, like, going on the street, they arrest them. There were even, like, some testimonies of, like, mother, like, well, my son was going to work and he was walking, and then they just beat him and arrest him, and he's in jail, and he's accused of that and that and that. And, like, so they just tried to, like, arrest that much person. We were more than 100, I think, first. And then we were, like, 44 left after a couple of days. And now there's still, like, 12 or 15 persons inside and in jail. And there's many persons who cannot have a bail. There's many persons that already pay bail. There's some that still can pay one, but most of the people that are still inside are the most, like, difficult cases. Many persons have been tortured, too. Threatening of, like, we'll kill you and things like that, really, like, psychologic. And when I was in jail, like, for me, it was so difficult to have information about my thing. My parents were, like, informing me about what was going on and what they were saying and when I was supposed to go back, you know. For the people who are still inside in jail, like, for us, it's so difficult to get information to know about what's going on, when are they going to be out, will they going to be out or not, or...
The demonstrations in Guadalajara illustrated a growing discontent to neoliberal economic policies in Mexico and throughout Latin America, specifically multilateral and bilateral trade agreements. 10 years after NAFTA, the North American Free Trade Agreement, a conscious and mobilized people of Mexico had tasted the often cruel effects of economic policies pushed by the North. And in late May 2004, the streets of Guadalajara were filled with what was a resounding rejection of such neoliberal economic policies. Maria Bentes of the Guadalajara Independent Media Center, which brought together media activists from throughout the world to cover the Guadalajara summit, speaks about how neoliberal economic policies have affected the people of Mexico.
In these demonstrations, there was people from all over the world. I mean, few people from all over the world, but there was their presence there. But I think we all get united by one demand that was, let us decide our future. Let us think what we want to think. Let us create what we want to create. The thing about the European Union and the Latin America group, that they were planning to make a new trade between these two big blocks, America and Europe. So we were also telling what was going on there inside. No, I mean with people who was signing this new kind of trade. They are changing the life of people who live in that territories. They are destroying the environment. They are making new ways, new roads, and they are also militarizing all the area by putting little checkpoints. They are making little checkpoints in the roads, and they are making new commercial corridors. I mean, the change is in a lot of spheres: the biological, the energetic, the commercial, the military, and the way cultures live.
The government of Mexico estimates that today 40 million people live below the poverty level and 25 million in extreme poverty. NAFTA, or the North American Free Trade Agreement, was a radical economic experiment. Never before had a merger of three nations, Canada, the United States, and Mexico, with such radically different levels of economic development had been attempted. NAFTA was presented and signed as 900 pages of a one-size-fits-all document of trade rules to which each nation was required to conform all of its domestic laws, regardless of whether voters and their democratically elected representatives had previously rejected the very same policies in Congress, state legislatures, or city councils. Edward S. Herman, a U.S.-based economist and media analyst, recently wrote an article on the language used in such neoliberal policies enforced by so-called free trade agreements. He wrote, quote, "The phrase free trade is a masterpiece of deception and propaganda. It uses the word free, covers up the fact that the work of all those agreements and bodies very purposefully reduces the freedom of third world countries, diminishing their sovereignty and the power of their democratic institutions to shape their economic policies, to provide public services, and to protect their environment." The word trade in the phrase free trade obscures the fact that the agreements with that label and the institutions enforcing them frequently focus more heavily on investor rights than on trade. They're designed to allow corporations to do business in foreign jurisdictions without any threat that a democratic government might do them. And Hector de la Cueva of the Mexican Network of Action Against Free Trade, or RIMALC, speaks about the social movements in Mexico opposed to the neoliberal economic policies and specifically NAFTA, the North American Free Trade Agreement.
La RIMALC es una red de organizaciones sociales y ONGs.
RIMALC is a web of social organizations and NGOs that were founded in 1991. When North American free trade negotiations began, it gathers union, peasant, and popular organizations, as well as human rights centers, NGOs, feminist movements, etc. It is also a web that has been following free trade agreements that have been signed by Mexico. In general, we follow free trade policies all around the world, but we also are part of actions against the WTO and American Free Trade Agreement. So we follow up on treaties like the one with the European Union, and of course, we follow also what has to do with the North American Free Trade Agreement.
Mantenemos el seguimiento sobre el Tratado de Libre Comercio de América del Norte.
It was founded in 1991 after a forum we did in Zacatecas, and since the beginning we had relations with Canadian and American organizations. It's practically been 13 years since RIMALC was founded.
Los 20 años de neoliberalismo son los años de menor crecimiento en más de un siglo en México. Es decir, los mitos de que era algo que se necesitaba.
The last 20 years of neoliberalism in Mexico have been the years of least growth in more than a century. The myths that said that it was something needed against the protectionist or populist policies, what existed before. In 20 years of neoliberalism, there has been minor economic growth. The destruction of production industry, the destruction of national project, whichever this was, they say that the best project is the one that doesn't exist, although it has been crowned precisely with the North American Free Trade Agreement and other policies. So all these policies and some have not only stagnated the country, but they have had as a consequence a real social disaster. Definitely, there has been a loss of jobs, the minimum wage has fallen more than 30% under NAFTA. But if we see it within the context of 20 years of neoliberalism, it has lost more than 150% of its purchase value. Also, overall, the provinces, the poorest regions and rural areas, have suffered the worst consequences. We have devastated countryside. The reforms to the 27th article of the Constitution allowed to set aside the nation's property over land. So this implicates that misery forces farmers to sell their lands. Free trade has meant that peasants have to be subjected to a disloyal competition with North American farmers, which are highly subsidized. And besides, we aren't just talking of simple farmers. We're talking of true food corporations, which create a large disadvantage for Mexican farmers trying to compete. This also reflects itself in an increase of migration of rural and urban zones from Mexico to the United States. This has grown to a point that one of the main incomes of the country are the savings that Mexican workers send from the United States to Mexico. There are several regions that are surviving not thanks to the governmental policies, but rather due to the money and work that Mexicans make in the United States. So then, seen by any angle, these 20 years of neoliberalism in Mexico have implicated a real disaster for the country, and particularly the most affected are the popular and least protected sectors of the population.
Al trabajo que hacen mexicanos en Estados Unidos y que mandan sus remesas, ¿no? Entonces, desde cualquier ángulo, estos más de 20 años de neoliberalismo han implicado un verdadero desastre como país y en particularmente para los sectores más populares, más desfavorecidos en México, ¿no? Sí, definitivamente.
Well, yes, definitely it has gone deeply into the country. Fox's government has named itself the government of change, and in reality, it hasn't changed anything. Instead, it has deepened several things, among them the neoliberal policies and free commerce. So, in fact, Fox has done what every government has done at its own time. He carried up the model to its final consequences, despite past experiences. For example, in the case of the free trade agreement, Fox's government, instead of reviewing the negative effects of NAFTA, it is now proposing a NAFTA Plus. It is proposing the integration of a North American community. So what I mean is that it pretends to go deeply in a subordinated integration of Mexico to the United States. So then, in reality, Fox is accentuating the heritage that the neoliberal governments of the PRI have left behind. Fox is just retaking the model, stressing it, and deepening its effects, which create major social devastation. That is why during Fox's government, there have been some of the most important resistance struggles, like El Campo No Aguanta Más, that tries to face the situation in the agricultural sector, as well as the resistance of the Union of Federal Electricity Commission, that is against its privatization, because Fox insists on privatizing, etc. So what we see with Fox's government is the deeper implementation of this model, but that's taking him to a very uncomfortable and polarized situation with society. All the promises he made have not been accomplished and have resulted the contrary of its own expectations.
No tiene la culpa, mi amor, de tanto tiroteo. Va por la calle llorando, lágrima de oro.
The growing discontent with the Fox administration in Mexico, specifically to the economic policies pushed through multilateral trade agreements such as NAFTA, have been amplified by growing poverty levels. In Mexico, minimum wage has fallen over 30% since NAFTA was signed. Indigenous livelihood and cultures are increasingly being trampled through fast-track so-called economic development plans. Maureen Myers of Agustin Pro Human Rights Association in Mexico City, argues that the people of Mexico's basic human rights have been increasingly ignored in the face of neoliberal economic development plans.
Hi, my name is Maureen Meyer. I work for the Miguel Agustin Pro Juarez Human Rights Center in Mexico City. Our organization focuses both on providing legal defense for cases here in Mexico. We also do lobbying internationally, which is what I work on, looking at the Inter-American human rights system as well as the universal system of human rights. We do research and education programs and also have a communications area. Recently, most of our work is concentrated on looking at the human rights situation in Mexico. However, in what has to do with what we would term economic liberalization, or that sort of manifested in free trade agreements, we start to work more on a regional level, given the widespread reach of these agreements, and because they're obviously agreements between different countries. And in particular, in the past few years, there's been an increase in what we considered multilateral agreements, or regional agreements, such as the Free Trade Agreement of the Americas. So we've decided to work more on a regional level and looking at focusing on the impact of the implementation of these free trade agreements on human rights. With the experience of Mexico, we already have 10 years of the North American Free Trade Agreement, or NAFTA, and we've seen lots of effects on human rights, so we're wanting to look at how that situation is also starting to be reflected in other countries that are operating under the same neoliberal economic model.
Now, when we hear the leaders of countries such as Canada, United States, and even Mexico throughout the Americas speak about the effects of neoliberal trade treaties, the free trade area of the Americas, and now, as you mentioned, 10 years of NAFTA, there's rhetoric around freedom, prosperity, economic opportunity. So maybe in a nutshell, could you talk about what your organization has seen specifically in regards to the results of NAFTA on communities in Mexico, indigenous communities, peasant communities, urban communities? What have the effects been?
Okay, what we have seen in Mexico, and I think if you look at even the increase in imports of luxury goods into the country, is that while NAFTA hasn't had a positive impact on the entire population, there's a slight part of the population that is doing really well with the free trade agreement, and therefore the government takes that as being a positive sign that NAFTA has been positive for the entire population. What we've seen in our work, and we work a lot with a lot of organizations in Mexico, particularly the North Mexican Action Network on Free Trade, and a lot of organizations that are part of that network, is that 10 years after NAFTA has been implemented, the impacts on the majority of the population in Mexico have not been beneficial. Actually, in the past month, the National Statistics Institute, INEGI, just released the fact that unemployment in Mexico is at the highest rate that it's been in the past 7 years. In the first 3 years of the Fox administration, almost half of the jobs lost were actually lost in the maquiladora, or the export processing sector of the economy. So we're looking at where there hasn't been, in the labor sector, the promised increase in jobs. There's actually been a huge job loss in the country, particularly after the Fox administration came into power in 2000. There are persistence of violations of labor rights within these factories that are being operated, particularly in the context of NAFTA. And there aren't that many remedies, even when you take into consideration the side agreement on labor, to really bring justice to these human rights violations, these labor rights violations in the context of the maquiladora sector. I think even a more drastic example of the negative impact that this agreement has had has been on the countryside in Mexico. And while you can't say that all of the problems facing the Mexican peasant sector are due to the North American Free Trade Agreement, a lot of the problems have been aggravated by this free trade agreement. Mexico is now spending, in the past 10 years, has spent $90 billion on food and importation of basic grains, which should be considered corn, beans, etc., has increased by double. So I think you're seeing on one side this huge amount of government spending on food imports, which could actually, had it not been for the agreement, could have been using that money to support national production, and instead they've chosen to buy cheaper imports from the United States and Canada, particularly in terms of basic grains. And with all of the subsidies in the United States and Canada and the lack of support of the countryside in Mexico by the government, right now actually a corn producer, it's estimated in certain studies by Oxfam that a corn producer spends about $120 to produce a ton of corn, and they're only going to get about $80 back by selling that corn, so it's not even economically viable for them to be producing, and then they're faced with a whole crisis of their livelihood, of their right to be a peasant, because if they're not being able to sell to get a profit, they don't have money to buy extra food, to pay for medical supplies, to pay for education. So it's a huge crisis within the countryside, putting at risk the food sovereignty of the country, the quality of the food that is being imported, and also the livelihood of the peasant sector itself. And those are just two examples within the labor sector and the countryside. You know, of the negative impacts of the free trade agreement. I would say one other would be within the environment. I think the increase in logging in Mexico has been significant since the free trade agreement was signed in 94, and there's been several cases of excessive logging by corporations from the United States, particularly in Mexico, in the context of this agreement.
Mm-hmm. One term that has been thrown around within circles organizing to oppose neoliberal policies or trade agreements such as NAFTA is the commodification of life. You spoke about the countryside and maquiladoras. Maybe can you expand a little bit on how, from your perspective, NAFTA and the economic model which it has pushed in Mexico perhaps is in contradiction to the way of life of indigenous and peasant communities in Mexico historically?
I think that's one of the main points, is that now with this economic model, things such as your livelihood, you know, if you're a peasant, what you produce isn't necessarily viewed in a more global or integral manner of your way of life, but rather as merchandise. Maybe a key example of that would be access to medicine, you know, the privatization, or the push to look at intellectual property rights of large corporations, where the right to health of a population is then at risk because medicine is seen just as a commodity and not as something that could be used to heal someone, to treat patients, particularly with the case with HIV/AIDS. There's a whole push towards looking at everything just in terms of the market, and that obviously, in one sense, is contradicting to indigenous views on, you know, the integral part of their life, their relationship with the land and with their environment, which isn't looking at it from just a pure economic perspective, but rather a way of a whole global vision or cosmovision of the world. And at the same time, that perspective, just looking at the market, then basically says to people, well, if you aren't competitive in this market, if you don't have the money, then you just are left out. And so it's not looking at how poverty impacts then your access to medical care, if the medical services are privatized, or your access to medicine. I think an extreme case, even looking at the different logic, is the fact that the Secretary of Agriculture here in Mexico had said regarding the opening in the next few years of all of the tariff barriers on corn and bean production in Mexico that, well, Mexican producers, small-scale producers, basically have another few years to become efficient in the market, and if they can't become efficient, then they just have to look for something else to do. And that's not necessarily respecting, then, what we would consider, what we've called the right to be a peasant, or your right to livelihood. It's basically saying, well, sorry, you know, the market says you're not efficient, so you just have to go do something else. So it's a very contrasting view to what we believe would be a different model that's focused much more on justice and equity.
The third summit of the ALCUE in Guadalajara, which gathered representatives and presidents from 25 European countries, joined by 33 of their Latin American and Caribbean counterparts, represents an economic agenda which is increasingly being challenged. Irina, a social justice activist and anarchist organizer based in Mexico City, breaks down the ideas behind the growing challenge to neoliberal economics in Mexico and throughout Latin America.
Well, basically the main idea is that pretty much every single country in Latin America has suffered from neoliberalism. And that means that our countries are getting poorer, and our governments and the rich people are getting richer. Right now, for example, there's a lot of treaties going on from Mexico to the Patagonia. For example, Plan Puebla Panama, which is like a bridge to get basically American merchandise in a really big hallway from the U.S. to Panama. What they're doing is they are already building a lot of maquiladoras around the bridge, like around that big road. They are building from here, from Puebla, which is like an hour south from Mexico City, all the way to Panama. So it's basically all Central America. And it's to have free access. And most of these maquiladoras are like denim, and that industry, like the clothing industry, it's an industry that needs a lot of water. And Puebla is a place really well known because it has like really good water, has a lot of sweet water. So it was like the perfect spot for them to put maquiladoras. And of course, all the pollution from those maquiladoras stays in this country. And well, some people is sure that that is not benefiting no one but our governments and the people who is in charge of the industry. So some people realize that. I mean, there were like people from all over, not just like from Latin America, but from Europe. They were here demonstrating because we know those treaties are not good for the economics or the lives of people. We see that since NAFTA and CAFTA, it's like really unfair the way, well, we're trading our land for nothing, for things wrapped in plastic. So basically, what the rich countries need is the natural resources from Latin America. And so I think that's like the main problem, and that's why most people is demonstrating. That's why poor people think, well, we don't have anything to lose. We lost everything already. So right now the situation, like in the fields, like campesinos, they don't really have like another choice. I mean, that's why most people is immigrating to the United States or Canada, because, well, here you cannot live out of your field as it was when my grandparents were like my age. So that's like a lot of problems, and especially like in the city, we see that like a lot of people from small towns emigrate to our city, to Mexico City, because they think they're going to find a better job or a better opportunity, and when they don't find it, well, they don't have another choice but to go to the U.S., like try to cross the border illegally. And here, since Fox started as president, well, a lot of people have lost their jobs. I think the poverty levels are growing even more. So I think that's basically why people say we don't want that anymore. That's why they are like resisting, and that's why they went to the streets and tried to talk to the people and let them see that those treaties are no good for anybody.
You mentioned something, which is that people who are living in poverty in Latin America, we can talk about specifically indigenous people, they have nothing left to lose. Can you maybe expand a little bit on, say, the conditions in the maquiladora? What do these essentially work camps look like? How do they function? And how do they affect the communities which these maquiladoras are placed in?
Yeah. Well, a maquiladora is basically a huge factory. It's like a huge factory. Most of the time it's just for assembling. They assemble TVs, or they assemble jeans, or they assemble cars, or stuff like that. So there are like huge lines. Most of these things don't have any natural lighting. They don't have windows. It's very, very close most of the time. They get very, very hot in the summer and very, very cold in the winter because they are made out of iron. Pretty much all the building is like that. There are like big, big lines with maybe 30 people working at least per line, from 30 to 100. It depends what they are assembling. So in the case of jeans, for example, one person is starting sewing the other person like is checking, it's like really well done. The other person is doing the wash, the other person is putting the buttons, stuff like that, till the product is finished. And at the end of the line, they have another person in charge of checking that people is working and they are not, you know, just chilling or hanging out, but working. So it's like that. Basically, they start working from 5 or 6 a.m. to shifts, I don't know, from 2 or 3 p.m., but most people want to do overtime. So some of these people work their 12-hour shifts. Most of these people don't have, like, any social security because the contracts they have are not for years, but for weeks. I think every week they renew their contract. And that means that the workers are not allowed to unionize or to organize nothing because they don't know for how long are they going to be in the maquiladora. And also, well, in the specific case of Puebla, all the maquiladoras that are right now are not ready from urban places. They are basically in small towns with indigenous people. So it's perfect because the land in those places costs less. It's cheaper to get land and build a factory there. And they can do whatever they want because there's no authorities around and there's not really like a lot of regulations for these places, for these maquiladoras. And of course, all the pollution they create goes to those people's lands, goes to their water. And since being a campesino no longer pays because from the field, you cannot live out from your field anymore. So that's like the other alternative for people. They say, well, I cannot like work in my land anymore, so I'm going to work at the maquiladora because that's the only place I have left. So they start working there, and that means that less and less people is in charge of their lands, or they lose their lands because they cannot live out from them. So that's what's going on. And, of course, a really big part of the culture of those communities is not the way it used to be. Like, the whole agriculture thing, it's nothing because, well, people need something to eat. And, well, there's, like, a lot of problems also because around the maquiladoras, there's no housing available. So people live, like, really far away from there. Sometimes the maquiladoras have an extra business, which is a transportation. So they say, well, they can meet in some town where, like, a lot of people work. And so they have a bus, pick the people there, and get them to the maquiladora for an extra fee. So the maquiladora makes sure that the salary they're paying to the workers, part of it is going to be for the transportation, which is also from the maquiladora, is part of the maquiladora. So it's like, it's the perfect business. And they have all these stores around the maquiladora. They create like a really small city around the maquiladora, so people don't want to spend their money anything else but around that area, so all the money is for them. And, well, of course, it's affecting like a lot of rivers in Puebla, specifically this town called Tehuacan. And the water from Tehuacan is really famous. Like, in the past, a lot of people used to go there because it's like thermal water. And a lot of companies right now are in Tehuacan because, well, right now the water is not free anymore because there's a lot of companies who are making business with water. So the best places to get drinking water are already occupied by other maquiladoras for selling water. And the other rivers are used as the dumpsters of the other maquiladoras with all the toxic fluids, especially from the denim industry. That's basically what it is. Most people who work in these places is very poor. Some of them don't even speak Spanish because they come from indigenous places. So that makes it like even harder. Like, they don't know what kind of agreement they are signing when they get their contracts every week. So that's perfect for the people in the maquiladoras because, well, since people don't know how to read Spanish, well, they don't know what kind of business is that.
Mm-hmm. You talked about a change in the culture of indigenous communities who are affected by these economic development projects. Traditionally, indigenous communities lived and thrived from the land on which their communities were based. Now we're seeing a shift, and these communities are being used by often international or multinational corporations, which are creating these work zones, these maquiladoras. Can you maybe speak about this change from a historical connection to the land of indigenous communities to the conditions today, and how summits like the one that took place in Guadalajara have affected this process?
Well, yeah, like agriculture is something very important, and well, people call Mexicanos la gente del maíz, which is like people from corn, because in the past, the basic element of the Mexican diet is the corn, and the cornfields were like really, really famous. So it's like a tradition, like agriculture in the Mexican culture is a tradition. And in places, for example, like from the middle of the country going down south, basically there's like agriculture, because the land, it's very good land and rains a lot. It's very, in the past it was like the best way to make a living, to be into agriculture, because you were not buying food, you were basically trading your food with other families. And right now you cannot do that any longer. Because another maquiladoras like El Monte or Chiquita Banana, those are buying like huge portions of land from those families. So those families don't work in their lands anymore because those are part from a multinational corporation. So some people have been forced to leave their lands and go and live somewhere else. And for example, in the case of the maquila, most people who work in the maquilas are women. Because the other half of the population, which is the men, they are like crossing the border to go to the U.S. and work. So that's another phenomenon that's taking place. Most towns around the maquiladoras are only like women and kids, because like the brothers, the grandparents, and the fathers are absent because they went to look for money in another country. So that is completely different, because in the past, most kids in those small towns were raised by the whole community, not by the concept of nuclear family. So that is also affecting a lot of the way they perceive life. And also, well, since their houses are really, really far away from the maquiladoras, they are not allowed to go to their home and have food or have dinner in their places. So they are not cooking anymore the way they used to. And most of the stuff they're buying is packed. They are buying all these microwave things they can eat, like, in their workplace. And, of course, they are buying them in stores that have, like, agreements with the maquiladoras. So their whole diet is, like, changing because of that. And also, well, like, most of the problems happening in the communities are because of the influence of other people, like, working in the maquiladoras. In the past, having gangs in small towns like those, that was not a problem in Mexico, and right now it is a problem. Now there's like a lot of gangs, there's like crime, and those things didn't happen. And of course, those agreements like NAFTA, for example, those agreements are affected the lives of those people like in a really huge way. People is totally changing their lifestyle because they are getting kicked off their lands, or because they are losing their families, because, well, the father has to work in the U.S. and the mother has to work in the maquiladora. Otherwise, they don't eat. They won't survive.
Mm-hmm. You've talked about the economic situation, the desperate poverty which exists in various rural communities in Mexico, especially indigenous communities. Can you maybe summarize, given this situation, why people mobilized at Guadalajara and took these issues to the streets, and because of this experienced such extreme state repression?
Why we went to the streets? Because we think it's very unfair the way the world is functioning nowadays, because we think it's very unfair to see that our president and these other people have billions and billions of dollars, and there's communities who don't even have, like, running water to survive. So we want to go to the streets to say, ya basta, you know, to say we don't want this anymore. Even if some people think we cannot stop that, we're going to try. because we don't want a globalized world, like, even more, you know, economically. So if they are going to globalize the economy, we're going to globalize our struggle. So I think that's basically why people went there, because we know it's unfair. It's totally unfair what a group of people that don't even represent us as citizens of the world is doing in our name. So I think that's the main reason why people feel that, well, we have to get into the streets. We have to let them know we don't agree. We have to let them know that we have another view. We think that another world is possible, and we think that there's like a lot of alternatives which doesn't involve capitalism at all. And, well, the repression is like very terrible. Like, the enemy is in our house. It's not in another country. It's not in another continent. It's not in another culture. It's in our culture. Like, fascism is growing everywhere you go. Like, fascism is in our clothes, in our food, in our everything. So I think we have to do something about it. And a lot of people think the same way. And, well, I think the repression is this big because, well, the people who have the power is very scared that we want to take that power in our hands. Or maybe because they think we are too dangerous for their economic purposes.
You have been listening to a one-hour radio documentary looking at the May 2004 mobilization in Guadalajara, Mexico, where thousands of protesters gathered on the streets from throughout Mexico, Latin America, and the world to oppose the third summit of the ALCUE, which gathered representatives and presidents from 25 European countries, joined by 33 of their Latin American and Caribbean counterparts for closed-door negotiations regarding economic and political policies affecting more than 1 billion of the world's people. In response to the demonstrations in Guadalajara, the Mexican state orchestrated a police and security forces operation in which demonstrators were rounded up, severely beaten, and in many cases tortured during their subsequent incarceration. Human rights organizations from throughout the world, such as Amnesty International and Human Rights Watch, have condemned the Mexican state's treatment of demonstrators in Guadalajara. The Battle of Guadalajara continues. More than 4 months later, upwards of 15 activists are still imprisoned, 12 ineligible for bail, and 43 more face grave charges of riot, assault on police officers, destruction of property, and carrying arms. The demonstration in Guadalajara illustrated a growing discontent to neoliberal economic policies in Mexico and throughout Latin America, specifically multilateral and bilateral trade agreements. 10 years after NAFTA, a conscious and mobilized people of Mexico had tasted the often cruel effects of economic policies pushed by the North, and in late May 2004, the streets of Guadalajara were filled with what was a resounding rejection of the ALCUE summit and the neoliberal economic model throughout Latin America. For more information on the May 2004 demonstrations in Guadalajara, visit the Independent Media Center at www.indymedia.org. Follow the links to Guadalajara Independent Media. This one-hour radio documentary was recorded and produced for CKUT Radio in Montreal by Fabien Durand and Stéphane Christophe in Montreal. To get more information or to get involved with CKUT's Community News Collective, contact us by phone at 514-398-6788 or visit us on the web at www.ckut.ca, or you can send us an email at news@ckut.ca.
A la del alfabetización.